An interview with E. John Hanna at his home at 1116 Palo Verde Avenue, Long Beach, California. The date is Tuesday, April 26th, and the interviewer is Ann Andres. John, I usually begin by asking about a person's parents. So tell me something about your father and your mother, your name, where you're from.
Well, mother was born in Birmingham, England in 1889 and came to this country when she was 22 years old, at which time she met my dad, who was born in 1869 in Oil City, Pennsylvania, and I believe they met somewhere up in the Portland area, because that's where I was born in 1918. And when I was about 6 weeks old, my parents moved to Long Beach, and of course, that's where the family home has been ever since.
Why did they come to Long Beach,
I had no idea why my parents came to Long Beach. Dad had worked as a farmer, a wheat farmer in Canada, Manitoba. And mother was working for a department store, as I recall, up in Portland. And why they chose to come to California, Long Beach, I don't know.
What kind of work did your father do when he came to Long Beach?
Dad was a promoter, and he got involved in buying apartment houses, and he owned leased the drugstore on 7th and Long Beach Boulevard, which at that time was right across the street from Ward's drugstore, which Ward's, of course, is still there. But he leased that whole block. And the old post office used to be in that block, just north of the YMCA. And he ran the drugstore there and leased out the property around it. At one time, he owned the art theater at Fortune Cherry. And it seemed like Dad made investments in oil and things like that. And when he came to Long Beach from Canada, he had about $250,000 in Canadian war bonds, and he lost every bit of it in Long Beach. And Dad used to say that he lost it because there were so many shysters and so many crooks in Long Beach. But up in Canada, a man's word was as good as his bond. Mm-hmm. But he found out here in Southern California that was not the case. And Dad made a lot of mistakes and lost practically all of his money. And eventually bought a little liquor store at 424 Pacific Avenue. And of course, he was up in his late 60s at that time, and had suffered with rheumatism and other arthritis problems, and so he ran that liquor store with mother's help for a number of years before he finally passed away in 1942 at the age of 73. Mm-hmm. And mother continued to operate the liquor store for several more years, at which time she sold the store.
You said he had oil investments locally in Signal Hill?
Yeah, well, when he first came to Long Beach in 1919, he wanted to buy some property up on Signal Hill, but mother talked him out of it because the property he wanted to buy was covered with chicken coops and farm equipment and things like that, and mother said he wants to buy a bunch of those chicken coops. Well, of course, the very next year they struck oil, and if Dad invested in that property when he wanted to, he probably would have been worth a lot of money. But mother talked him out of it, and he did invest in one oil thing that came to pass, and which I'm still getting dividends on after all these years. But it's a very, very small amount, but it certainly recouped his investment many times over.
Was that on Signal Hill?
That was the Malcolm Groat lease, and I'm not too sure, Ann, where that's located. But he did invest, of course, in a number of other oil companies, none of which ever panned out. Mm-hmm. He lost every time except that one Malcolm Groat lease that he put his money into paid off.
You hear so many stories about people who maybe made it big, but then you hear an awful lot of stories about people who didn't make anything.
That's right.
I interviewed George Magruder, and he said his dad had a chance to buy 5 acres in the corner of Well, I think it was willow and cherry or something like that. And his dad said, well, that's too far out. I couldn't get to work down at the park. And well, then it turned out to be the Love Lady pool. You know, this kind of thing. You know, you hear an awful lot of this, but some of it maybe is exaggerated, you know.
A lot of what-if stories, I'm sure, you know, missed opportunities. But that's what makes up life.
So where did you live then, in the family, when you were growing up?
Well, we had moved around quite a bit, Ann, as I recall, when we came to Long Beach. I think our first home was at Tents and Cherry. And we lived there for a period of time, and then I think we moved over to Cedar and 12th. And we lived there for a period of time, and but we moved around to different places in Long Beach. When the earthquake hit in 1933, we were living over 7th and Atlantic Avenue, just off of 7th and Atlantic Avenue, right by the church.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived out in Midway City for a couple, 3 years. Dad had some lots out there in the house, and we lived out there for a period of time. Midway City is called Midway City because it's midway between Long Beach and Santa Ana.
Oh.
We've got its name.
Oh, it's out that way.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I
went off to George Washington School. At that time, the 1920s and 30s, Washington was a combination elementary junior high school.
Oh.
So we went there to kindergarten, went all the way through the ninth grade. And then from there, of course, when I graduated from George Washington, I went to Poly High School and put in 3 years there. Graduated from Poly in 37.
While you were at Poly, did you by any chance take any classes from Kathleen Harnett?
No, I never did, but of course Sylvia had a class from her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I never had any classes from Kathleen Harnett.
Well, then I know that one of your big activities from put on as an appointment. So, how old were you when you started in the choristry?
Well, I was 12 years old when I joined the choir in 1930.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was the 17th choir boy to be signed by Mr. Dorr to be in the choir. He brought over, of course, 8, 9, 10 boys, as I recall, from Palos Verdes, where he lived and where he taught school and taught music in the school over there. And when he started the choir in 1930, he brought these boys over to form the nucleus for the Sentinel Choristers. And of course, the rest of the boys were all recruited from within and outside the church. But my brother and I, we have 17 and 18 numbers on our choir certificates.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in the choir from 1930 until 1937, when I left Long Beach to go to the University of California, Berkeley, where I had a scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Austin, who was at that time the rector at St. Luke's, was instrumental in getting me a scholarship to Berkeley, and so I left Long Beach in 37 and went up there. So I got the choir then after 1937 until after the war, actually, when I came back and was in the choir for maybe just a couple of years. And dropped out, and those two tours of duty in the choir was the extent of my choir experience.
Well, was that at that time, was the choir singing in movies and Hollywood?
Oh, yes, it was. As a matter of fact, I remember participating in several of the motion pictures that the choir sang in. Bobby Breen and Rainbow on the River and Jeanette McDonald and Ronald Coleman and San Francisco and I sang in Green Light, and as a matter of fact, I remember seeing myself on TV here just a year or so ago when they played the Green Light movie. That was the one starring Anita Louise and Sir Cedric Hardwick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember
the movie. Yeah, Green Light. So it's funny to see myself as a 14, 15-year-old boy. But so I sang in quite a few movies, and of course, that was just about the time in the late middle 30s when we were getting very active in motion picture work. And Mr. Dorr, as I recall, was a great promoter. He was always getting Hollywood motion picture producers to find a use for the choir in pictures, either just our voices or in some cases we also appeared personally. And of course, we did a lot of taping of music. We made a lot of records, too, in those years. But that was all coming just about the time that I left the choir. The choir was very active in the motion picture field, of course, between 1937 and 1950, which is just about the time Mr. Gore left St. Luke's. Mm-hmm. He was there 20 years as the choir director.
So would you credit him for the music program that continues at St. Luke's now?
Oh, I certainly would, Ann. I think he gave us the motivation and the inspiration to carry on with a choir of men and boys. And there's very, very few Episcopal churches that have such choirs these days. And I think Father Young wants to keep the choir going. And I think, by and large, the people in St. Luke's who enjoy good music and want to, you know, have a relationship with the old English Anglican communion, boy choirs, interested in seeing the choir continue. There have been comments made from time to time that we're discriminating against the women and the girls by not letting them sing in the choir, but that would break the tradition that we want to maintain. And after all, that choir is 53 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been women's choirs and choirs for women and girls in the past, but at the present time, I guess there isn't any. And I was hoping that maybe Mr. Coring would be able to get such a choir organized. Of course, the thing is, we only have, besides the 8 o'clock service, we just have one service on Sunday morning now. Well, we used to have two services, you may recall. The women's choir sang at one, and the boy choir the other, but now it's just one choir with just one service. Why? And as long as we keep the boys' choir, so obviously they're going to be the ones to sing at that service. So the pressure, I think, for a women's and choir at this time has been somewhat relaxed.
Was it Perry Austin who thought of bringing Richard Door there, or had members in the congregation suggested, or do you know?
And I don't recall. I was, of course, just a young boy then, and I have no idea as to how Perry Austin and William Ripley Dorr got acquainted. Mr. Dorr had been working as a organ representative, selling organs for an organ company, and somehow Mr. Dorr apparently met Perry Austin and got talking about setting up a choir at the church, and he was employed to be the choir director and the choir master and the organist. But what brought those two men together, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, then it was Perry Austin who brought about radio broadcasts from the church.
Yes, that's right. K-Fox. Right. K-Fox broadcasted the morning services from St. Luke's for a number of years, as I recall. And as a boy, you know, in the choir, I remember the people from the radio station being there on Sunday morning, setting up the broadcasting booth and so forth. And Dr. Austin, of course, was a fine preacher, and he always had a worthwhile message to pass along to those who wanted to listen to him. And it wasn't until his health broke down many years later following the earthquake that, his sermons lost some of their effectiveness, I think. And he was the one that was responsible for setting up the radio broadcast there at St. Luke's, which continued for many years.
Well, he was also, he became rector at a time when the whole city was expanding and growing, and I imagine he was instrumental in the expansion of St. Luke's, too, and the congregation.
Yes, he was. He certainly was. He not only was responsible for getting the boy choir started, but he was instrumental for developing a very fine, a very strong men's club there. It consisted of over 100 men. My dad used to go to that men's club, as I recall, and they had a very strong guild system there at the church. There are many women's guilds and so forth. And he was very program-oriented and very people-oriented, and he was always putting on things that drew people to the parish. And One of the things that I used to always remember him saying was when people would criticize the Episcopal Church for using its parish hall for dances and for card games was that he said, you know, we believe in consecrating our pleasures rather than desecrating them. And it just tickled me to hear him say that because a lot of denominations, of course, I don't believe in using their church facilities for dancing or what have you.
Well, I know a month or so ago we were all talking about the earthquake, so why don't I ask you about the earthquake? I know you've said it several times, but let's say for our sake, what were you doing when the earthquake struck?
Well, when the earthquake hit Palm Beach on the 10th of March, 1933, I was out in the YMCA. I had been out in the YMCA that evening playing basketball, and I left the Y about 5:30 and walked home. We only lived about 5 or 6 blocks away. And I got home just a few minutes before the quake hit. And I recall that first night we got into our car and drove up to Signal Hill and slept up there for 1 or 2 nights, as I recall, because there were rumors going around the city about a tidal wave.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought the earthquake was bad enough, but we didn't want to get swept out in the ocean by a tidal wave, so we went to high land, top of Signal Hill. And then I think also when we were assured that there was no tidal wave coming, we went to Recreation Park, and I think we stayed out there for a few nights before we finally moved back into our apartment over at, near the church, 7th Atlantic Avenue.
Have the apartment been damaged?
No, no damage to the apartment house at all. But the house next to us, of course, lost its brick chimney, and I remember my mother and I and my brother came out the kitchen. We were on the second story. We paused out there just for a minute to collect our thoughts before we went down the stairs and ran out in front. And it was a good thing we did because had we proceeded directly down those stairway, we probably would have had that big chimney on our heads.
Mm.
As it was all lying on the ground, and we walked over that as we found our way out to the front of the apartment house. And, of course, my dad, he was lying down on a sofa in the front room, and it knocked him off the sofa, and the bookcase fell over on top of him, but apparently he was all right because he eventually struggled and found his way down the stairway, and he met us out in the front.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody got hurt, and there was very little damage to the apartment house. It was a four-flat apartment house. Four families lived there,
mm-hmm.
Four units.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, Ann, I can't tell you too much more about the quake. As far as the church is concerned, I do remember the construction company spending 2 or 3 days trying to pull down the spire on the old church building. They had an awful time getting that down, and they worked on that for hours and hours and hours before they finally were successful in getting that steeple pulled down. And, of course, I also recall, as far as the church is concerned, helping Mr. Doerr move all the organ pipes from the nave over the chancel over to the parish hall,
mm-hmm.
for safekeeping and for storage. And the organ, of course, itself was not moved to the parish hall, but the pipes were moved, and I recall the young boy helping Mr. Doerr do that.
Do you remember singing in that first service that was held outside on the
Yes, right. We sang just outside the parish hall on the steps. That's where the services were conducted.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly remember singing at that service.
And then what happened then? Were the services moved inside in the parish hall, or?
I think we had a number of services out in front there, and eventually the church services were held in the parish hall, and they were held in there until such time as a new church was built.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the service of dedication then, following July of?
The one that was held in the new church?
Yeah.
It's very, very fuzzy in my mind, although I suppose I should remember it, because in one of the pictures that were taken of that service, I saw myself in there holding the cross. So apparently I was a crucifer at that time, and I should remember that service, but I really don't.
Well, as a boy growing up in Long Beach, the kinds of things that you do besides play basketball or the line?
Well, I was very active in intramural athletics at George Washington School, and we used to stay after school and play speedball, I guess it's called soccer now, and basketball and softball and knock up and lay down and things like that. And between that and the YMCA, where I was very active in the club down there and so forth, that was pretty much the extent of my activities.
When did you start playing table tennis?
I started playing table tennis at the Long Beach YMCA in 1930. I took up the game and played down there and became quite good, won several YMCA and city championships. And I'll never forget, I was playing down there one day and the fellow walked up to the counter and said, who's your best table tennis player around here? And the guy said, well, that fellow over there is playing to me. And so this guy came over and introduced himself as Gordon Templeman. And said he'd like to hit a few with me. And he proceeded to play, and he pulled out a rubber paddle, which I'd never seen before. I was playing with just a plain wooden bat. And he just cleaned my whistle, but good. And after we got through playing, I found out that he was a former Pacific Coast table tennis champion, and we became very, very good friends, and he coached me and helped me with my game. And I improved, of course, quite a bit and became quite good in table tennis. As a matter of fact, in 1967, I ranked number 4 nationally in the men's over 40 division. That's the men over 40 years of age, the seniors. And I guess, Ann, over the years, I won over 250 table tennis trophies and emblems and plaques and what have you for table tennis tournaments and so forth. And I was also very active, of course, in the administrative end of the game. I served as the Pacific Coast Regional Tournament Director for the United States Table Tennis Association for a number of years. And in that job, of course, I was responsible for sanctioning all tournaments held on the West Coast for the USPTA, and for receiving the results of those tournaments, and for sending those in to the Table Tennis Topics magazine for publication and for ranking purposes and that type of thing. So I've been, and I was president of the Long Beach Table Tennis Club. I was the first president of the California Table Tennis Association following the war, held that job for 2 years. So I've been active in table tennis and enjoyed it very, very much. And as a matter of fact, I still play one morning every week with my table tennis buddy, Gene Roseman, who lives out in Lakewood. We go to Leisure World here to the Seal Beach Table Tennis Club. They have a lovely club over there, good tables, good lighting, and a good run-back room. And so I still keep my hand in the game, but I haven't played much competitive table tennis in the last 5 years, maybe 3 tournaments. Once in San Diego, I played in the Nationals in Las Vegas a year ago, and I played in a tournament over here in San Bernardino about 3 months ago. But I really don't play any competitive table tennis to speak of anymore.
How about your tennis game?
Well, I'm probably playing better tennis right now than I played a long, long time, and that's just simply because we have a tennis court right here in the Bixby Hill Garden condominium complex. And there's a lot of fellas in here that like to play tennis, both singles and doubles. So I go out and I play tennis maybe 2 or 3, sometimes 4 times a week. So my game has improved considerably, and it's helped me get my weight down. I feel good, and so I'm really, really enjoying being able to play tennis.
Well, what kind of activities did you take part in high school then, besides the table tennis and tennis?
Well, in Poly High School, are you speaking?
High
school? Uh-huh. Okay, well, at Poly High School, I was president of the student body, I recall, and I was commissioner of affairs 1 year at Poly High School. I played the piano for the George Washington. I'm going back to Washington now. I played the piano for the George Washington Glee Club. I was out to the tennis team at Poly High School, played number 1 on the varsity. And I was active in high school, and as I recall, I was the assistant business manager for the yearbook, Cerulea, and I know Mother was active in the PTA there at Poly High School, and I kept very busy in school affairs and school activities, and I enjoyed Poly very much, and I guess my biggest memory of Poly High School was that when I, in my senior year in 1937, I was selected by the Inner Service Club Council of Long Beach as the outstanding junior citizen in Long Beach. That was the year that William Grafe, president of the Southern California Edison Company, won the senior or adult award. They had two awards, adult and a junior, and I was the junior recipient. And I, you know, I felt quite good about by that, although I didn't think I deserved it because I knew I went to school with a lot of boys and a lot of girls who, in my opinion, were much better qualified for that award than I was. But I did receive that award, and I still have fond memories of that.
What made you decide to go to town?
Well, I got a scholarship. Otherwise, I probably would have gone to Cal State Long Beach or maybe to Long Beach City College. But I was I got a scholarship, and Dr. Austin was instrumental in getting me the scholarship. He really went to bat for me, and as a result, I left Long Beach in 37 and went to Berkeley.
What did you major in at Berkeley?
My major changed two or three times during my 4 years at Cal, but I finally wound up majoring in just general curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
General curriculum, I think, was the... most of my courses were in the field of political science and public administration. And as a matter of fact, I later on went to USC, and got all my work done for my master's except to finish my thesis, which I never did. I ran out of money, ran out of time, and consequently I never did get my my master's degree for that reason. I did go to UCLA evening school and received a certificate in industrial relations. But outside of that, that's about the extent of my my education.
Did you like Berkeley?
Yes, I did, although it was quite a strange experience in a way for a fellow going from a high school of 3,200 students where I was, I guess I was kind of a big shot there at the school, a big fish in the pond, and then going up to Berkeley with 16,000 students there in 1937. I didn't know anybody, and nobody knew me, and... it was an entirely different environment. Mm-hmm. Really got knocked down to size real quick.
It happened to us all.
Yeah.
A lot of children. Where did you live while you were there?
1820 Euclid, which was an apartment house just about a half a block north of the campus. I lived there with two other boys from Long Beach, Jack Pegg, a former chorister, and whose mother was a choir mother at the church, and a fellow named Ross Anspoker, who also was a Long Beach boy. And the three of us lived together in 1820 Euclid for some period of time.
Mm-hmm. I ask these things because, as an old Berkeley person, you see, I can ask so somebody else might not ask you about what
right.
Well, during all this time, then, let's see, so you graduated from Berkeley.
41. Mm-hmm.
And during this time, were you dating Sylvia at this time? Had you gone together with Sylvia in high school? Or
Sylvia and I started going together in the very last semester in Poly High. I had been dating for about a year before that, Margaret Phillips, a very good friend of Sylvia's. And for some reason, that broke off, and I started dating Sylvia in the last semester at Poly High School. And, of course, she went to Cal.
Oh, she did.
You see, same time I did in 37. So, naturally, we dated up there. But we not, you know, we weren't serious or anything like that. We just happened to have a few dates, but she went out with other boys, and I went out with other girls.
When were you married then?
We were married in 1940.